I think this question, do you want to repeat the question?
The question has to do with whether or not, again, you're asking me to speak for the university as a whole.
I'm asking you to speak for your office.
All right.
For student affairs.
I can't even speak for my own office because we have decentralization within my own office. I can only speak for myself. I would not automatically send him a copy. If he made inquiry, I would tell him or even show him the letter. I don't know what the practice of the rest of the office would be. I would suspect that they would not send carbon copies to students, but would reveal the information and the assessment if the student asked for it. Usually, information that goes to a prospective employer is known to the individual student.
How does he know what you say, Doctor?
He doesn't know what I said in the letter, but he knows what I have appraised him. See, that isn't a good grammatically correct, but he knows my appraisal because I will have discussed it with him as a counselor. So he has full knowledge of what appraisal I have made of him, and therefore he has some knowledge of what I'm going to say.
Another question from your fellow panelist, please.
I'd like to also comment on that.
Oh, excuse me.
The question was stated in terms of a prospective employer asking someone in the Dean of Student Service to comment on a student. And at least with the small number of situations with which I have come into contact, the student has given the employer my name out of a whole lot of other names. The student has requested, in effect, that I provide information to the prospective employer.
Where do you get that information? I don't understand. I am a student. I graduated from the University of Minnesota. I go out and apply for 20 jobs. Now, this is my university graduate, that I'm a university graduate in 1927. And the employer goes ahead and writes a letter. I don't understand, as a student, neither of my daughters have indicated in their application to work which counselor to write. And here you say that they graduated from the University of Minnesota. Dean Williamson indicates that he has made a determination, or his office has made a determination, what to disclose to the employer or what not to disclose to the employer. What to disclose to the investigator of government who's seeking a loyalty determination from his record. I want to know what protection does the student get from him or from his office. I mean, I'm not trying to make this individualized, Dean Williamson, because I have respect for you as an individual. But I want to know what your office does in protecting the student who has already left it.
I think it would be interesting at this point to note that Mr. Stark's response assumed that an inquiry to him came from a student who had given his name as a reference. And it requires us, I think, to know what would happen if an employer's inquiry is not addressed to a particular officer of the university, but to the university itself, without reference to a particular officer, because, as Mr. Schwartz supposed, the student did not give the name of an individual as a reference, but only disclosed the fact that he had attended the university. Could one of you straighten this out factually on what would happen if that blind inquiry came?
May I add a question first?
Well, let me get just that one fact question now.
Well, I think that our university follows the general practice of other institutions of higher learning. Such a general inquiry would go to the college from which the individual graduated, because it is assumed that the faculty of the college is in the best position to make a determination of competence relevant to the job itself. Now, there are some other types of inquiries which traditionally come to my office. For example, we have inquiries addressed to the dean of men or dean of students from this Peace Corps, which is a special kind of new assessment. In those cases, we do try to collect the information from any faculty members, the head of the collegiate unit, and add any information that we may have in our files. And that goes out as our determination or our report. And sometimes we say, not known. because sometimes no one seems to know much about the individual. So you see, in part, the answer to your question is determined by who makes the inquiry for what purpose. In the case of the Peace Corps, it's, as in the case of civil service determinations, it's a question of, do you know any basis for judging that this man would be disloyal? And we say, no, we have no basis for it. That's usually the answer. In the case of competence for a job, that goes to the professors who have been training the individual in competence.
And on that point, I think Professor Sandelow would like to comment.
Can I try to generalize this in a comment about the whole line of questioning? Let me start with a thesis that perhaps will get me impeached from your board. My thesis is that, by and large, all of the questions thus far really don't relate to problems of privacy as such. That when students participate in activities around the university, when they engage in various activities, when they take various positions in a public forum of one kind or another, they have to expect that there is some possibility that what they have said and what they have done may be reported to people in the outside world. And students, like the rest of us, have to be prepared to take some consequences for their statements and for their actions. Now, I would exempt from this, as I would suppose that Dean Williamson would also, statements made by a student to someone in the counseling bureau in a counseling relationship. This becomes almost like a doctor-patient privilege, I suppose. And here we would expect the statements to be kept confidential. But I think when we're talking about problems of privacy, if we exempt for a moment that whole range of problems which has to do with the activities of government as such, we talk about the university or various private agencies in the society and the way in which they may intrude on our privacy. What we're primarily concerned with are those situations in which people have reason to believe that they are not behaving in a public fashion, and yet unknown to them, their activities are being made public. Wiretapping is a classic example. The wiretap would be useless if I knew that the cop was on the other end of the phone listening to what I was saying. The only reason that the wiretap is effective is that I do not know that the policeman or the private investigator is listening in. Similarly, in connection with Dr. Berninghausen said earlier about the woman who goes into the dressing room to try on some clothes and there's a television camera aimed at her. Presumably in this situation, she has no reason to believe that what she is doing is being observed by others. And then I think we have a real problem of whether her privacy is being invaded. But when all we're talking about is whether people shall be subject to having their activities or their statements reported, I don't think privacy is involved at all. I would argue that other problems may be involved. For example, as a faculty member, I would consider it inappropriate for me ever, under any circumstances, to tell a government investigator a position that a student had taken in class. But I don't think this is a problem of privacy. I think this is basically a question of academic freedom and the kinds of freedom which we want to guarantee people in a classroom situation. Now, perhaps others on the panel would like to disagree with this, or in the audience.
One of them is Professor Berninghausen. I would like to call to your attention some things about the questions about a student's loyalty. Jack, I'm sure you know that in 1961, the National Board of the ACLU took a position on this. The board approved this statement as guidelines for professors. Ordinarily, questions relating to what the student has demonstrated as a student, for example, the ability to write in a certain way, to solve problems, to reason consistently, to direct personnel or projects, pose no threat to educational privacy. But questions relating to the student's loyalty and patriotism, his political or religious or moral or social beliefs and attitudes, his general outlook, his private life, may well jeopardize the teacher-student relation. That's the ACLU statement. And at the University of California, the faculty took a position also on this point, saying, if it were generally known by students that their political and religious freedom to disclose beliefs, to express attitudes, to recount activities, and to refer to associations did not protect them from faculty response to loyalty security inquiries, many students in the classroom and in academic consultation would apply rules of caution differing markedly from the rules of free inquiry we now tend to take for granted. And also in Britain, the Council of the Association of University Teachers adopted a form notice for professors to use when being questioned by government investigators or anyone else. The Association of University Teachers has expressed its disapproval of questions concerning the political or religious beliefs, activities, or associations of students. I share this view and am not prepared to answer such questions.
That wasn't so much disagreement as it was just a stronger statement. And for three remarks from the panel, I've held you off now. Do you want to have your question now?
Well, I think the question's answered, sir.
The question that wasn't asked was answered.
Because I had a counterintelligence agent who asked me, and I didn't answer the question, what kind of art was this student interested in?
Did you all hear that? In the back of the room, a question. Professor Sandelow, I think the question was asked of you, and I think maybe you've already answered it.
Yeah, my position would be that it would be undesirable law professors pride themselves on teaching classes in an incomprehensible fashion. And if students had a chance to dissect what we've said for many hours on a tape, exams would be much too easy. But apart from that, I think it's clear that this is undesirable at any educational level. The reason for that is not that there is a right of privacy involved. It's because I think this has an inhibiting effect on the educational process. But let me try to demonstrate what I mean when I say that there is not a right of privacy involved here. When I take a position in the classroom, and I take positions in the classroom every day, I anticipate that in very many cases, students will walk outside of the classroom and report what I've said. If I was not willing to have them report what I have said outside the classroom, then I think I should not have said it. Now, the only difference that the tape recorder makes, so far as that problem is concerned, is that I have to risk that what I have said will be accurately reported. I don't think that's a very substantial risk for civil libertarians to worry about. And I think faculty members do have to be prepared to have their statements reported outside of the classroom. I am more concerned with the effect of the tape recorder on other students in the class than I am with the effect on the faculty member.
I think you want to be asked a follow-up question on this, Terry.
The instructor would not necessarily know. The existence of the Paradise California Social Studies teacher simply stumbles onto this. Suppose that you didn't know that there would not then be this existing effect.
There would not be... No, hey, let me... There, what I'm suggesting is that if all faculty members behaved as I think they ought to, there would not be an inhibiting effect on the faculty member in any event. But if students in the classroom realized that there was always a possibility that someone would be bringing a tape recorder in, I think that might have an inhibiting effect on the class. If I can take one more minute, let me analogize this to another situation, which is currently plaguing the Supreme Court. And indeed, in which perhaps Mr. Pemberton can help us out on this. I think the ACLU, if it has taken a position, has taken the wrong one. There is an old case on Lee against the United States. Not very old, but at the rate of turnover these days, it's an old case, which holds that if a police officer interrogates someone, see, in this particular case, I believed he walked into a Chinese laundry and interrogated the owner of the laundry. And unknown to the owner of the laundry, he had a tape recorder in his pocket and was taping everything that the laundry owner was saying. And the argument was made that the existence of the tape recorder somehow violated the rights of the laundry owner and constituted an unlawful search. Now, so far as I'm concerned, the existence of the tape recorder added nothing but accuracy. And since the laundry owner knew that whatever he said to the police officer might be reported, then I think he just took the risk, after all, that it might be reported very accurately rather than that it would be reported only as the police officer happened to remember it.
Unless I've got the wrong case, Terry, I think this was the one where the police officer, however, was outside of the laundry, and the person who went in carried not a tape recorder, but a radio transmitter. And the person who went in was not the police officer, but the laundryman's close friend. Again, you may make your argument that the laundry owner may well have known that what he told his friend would be repeated, and the only difference that the radio transmitter made was that there were two witnesses to the conversation, one of them a police officer. I don't know that ACLU was in the case. I do remember reading about it, but it was long enough ago that I don't know what position ACLU took. Here's a question right here.
I don't know whether this falls into purview of Mr. Sandalo's privacy issue. But I've been disturbed for some time by the fact that many police agencies gather what they term derogatory information, and the object of the person they gather it from never knows it. And the fact has no chance to reply to it when the information is used in a police report or comment. I'm just wondering whether it wouldn't be possible to provide that, at least in this case, a person in some sense faces accusing.
The question concerns, I take it, Sam, in police, in city anti-subversive squads and the like, collecting information, derogatory information about some individuals that they feel they must build a dossier about on. And of course, this not to the knowledge of the individual and without disclosure of the particular information, so that there is no confrontation of the derogatory information and the individual about whom it's written with any opportunity to correct it. Do you want to comment on this practice, Terry?
Shows what I get for volunteering to talk in a panel where I haven't dealt with the issues as carefully as I should. The first difficulty I have is that I'm not sure what use is going to be made of the information. If the information is to be used for some purpose, as I assume it is, not necessarily to prosecute the individual, but to deprive him of getting a job or a license that he wants from the city or something like that, then I think there are very serious problems relating to the denial of the right of confrontation and the right of cross-examination. And I would think in the situations where the police accept this information, that is, go around and make the secret survey without appraising or apprising the suspect, if you will, or the subject of the examination, of what has been said about him and who has said it, that not only are the police depriving this person of his rights, assuming they're going to take any action against him or deprive him of any benefits, not only are they depriving him of his rights, they're acting stupidly. And all too frequently, the police and the federal government agencies involved are just acting stupidly when they refuse to give people the rights of confrontation and cross-examination. The reason that these rights have been built into our legal system, after all, are not, as some people would tell us, that they happen to be technicalities grounded on the Magna Carta, but which no longer have any particular value. The reason for the rights of confrontation and cross-examination is that a very long history has convinced us that these are the best ways we have of obtaining the truth. And if what the police are interested in is obtaining the truth about the subject, I would think it would be to their interest as well as to his to let him know about the investigation.
I wonder if I could. Matt, I'll recognize you first.
I have a question concerning the role of the press in regard to invasion of privacy.
Well, Matt, then could I ask for an opportunity for those in the audience who wish to do so to attempt to wrap up the subject that the questions initially put to Dean Williamson raised in terms of what should be the civil liberties interest in practices of institutions of higher education with respect to reporting information about students. Are there questions on that subject before we go on to yours, Matt? There seem to be several. We'll start here. The question, I would think it would be put to Dean Williamson. If there were a member of the John Birch Society who also was a member of the faculty who would not decline to report on questions of loyalty, as the readings that Dave Brenninghausen gave us suggest that perhaps he should, what would his practices be? Do you want to speak to that?
I don't know of any institution that keeps a file of this character. And I'm kind of startled to think that you think that there might be such a file. But I suspect that it's probably a universal practice for the professor not to contribute to a central file of this character, but to have his own file, in which case he then makes a determination what he's going to report. And that's a matter for him, his own traditional right, as it were. I wouldn't think of keeping a file of this sort in my office. If I don't know of any institution where this is done, it may be, but I would think it'd be highly undesirable to keep such a file. But the professor is entitled to make his own appraisal and to report it to whomever he wishes to. I would hope that he'd be restrained, however, and that he would be, I'm thinking now like a psychologist, because appraisals and judgments about individuals are highly unreliable. See, they're subjective appraisals and ought to be evaluated accordingly, not taken as fact. See, if I say I think this individual is unstable, this is a technical judgment on my part, not a fact. Now, I would again go back to my criteria. Who's going to use the information? Is the individual receiving the information competent to determine, distinguish between fact and judgment? And this is where we have to be extremely careful when we pass out certain kinds of information, particularly that have to do with assessment of motivations and emotional stability and things of that sort. If the person receiving the information distinguishes between fact and appraisal and judgments, then you can say, in my opinion, see, and then you clearly label it as an opinion. And this seems to me to be so common sense a precaution that I would suppose it's pretty universal. Maybe I should say I hope it's universal.
Dean Williamson, on this subject of the student's loyalty, Professor Berninghausen read the practice of some people in England to deal with the problem, as I see it, of a fear that failure to report, acting as an individual professor, an opinion as to the loyalty of your student may be detrimental to a student of whose loyalty you have a high opinion. And yet, you may believe, as these professors obviously did, that such questions are improper, and if not invasions of privacy, Professor Sandelow, invasions of the classroom and harmful to academic freedom. The question I'm driving at is it desirable for the faculty in a collective action, such as these British professors did, to adopt a policy tending to discourage the reporting to outside agencies of opinions as to the loyalties of students, which may be based upon opinions expressed by the students themselves in the classroom?
Well, if I remember, this is the position taken by the faculty at Swarthmore a number of years ago, which precipitated a good deal of discussion. In my opinion, personally, I think it would be improper for me to release information and judgments and appraisals which are based upon what I hear in classroom discussion. Unless I'm asked. I noticed in the last half dozen years, the loyalty investigators are asking a different question. Do you know of any indication that this individual is disloyal? Now that question seems to me to be much easier to answer than to the positive question, is this individual loyal or disloyal? Usually I can say with a clear conscience, I don't know of anything that would indicate any questioning of his loyalty. But it would seem to me to be highly improper for me to report any concrete instance of conversation or remarks made or opinions expressed. If I'm asked for an appraisal of the individual loyalty in terms of what I know about him, I think I can answer that with good conscience. Do I get your question?
Thank you. Yes, you do.
Do you know Dean Williamson?
I am certain that he does not keep a dossier on every student. But I... Oh, yes, same as I do. We have a low crime rate of about 400 to 500 cases a year. We investigate, keep a file on those students. As a matter of fact, we keep the file indefinitely because we're doing some research on it. There's some very interesting research problems involved, and we do keep the file, yes, but not only on those cases that are reported to us. See, only when there is a specific complaint registered against a student, then we investigate to determine whether the complaint justifies any action on our part.
Matt, there were about four hands up when I held you off, but we have taken so much time that we're going to do injustice to other issues. I would like to have you change the subject at this point if you wish.
The question that question I would like to raise is, what is the role of the press? And by this I mean not only the newspapers, but radio and television, in terms of the action of the press in invading people's privacy. I think here of HUAC hearings, where information concerning the witnesses is supposed to be kept confidential, and somehow or other it's leaked to the press, and then it's reported. And then I think of another instance when Congress was investigating one of these criminals, and he was revealing all sorts of people's names in the interrogation, and the press reported this. What is the proper role of the press in this regard?
The question put, do you want to answer that question?
What I want to say is, don't let the press, when you act, leave its names to it, because of course the press will prove it.
The question really put to Matt, the remark really puts to Matt a question: is it properly a concern of the press?
I think there are many professional organizations.
I think you ought to come up here and take this mic and make sure everyone hears you.
I think there are many professional organizations which have ethical standards. And if somebody receives something illegally, should they use it? And if the press receives information that it perhaps shouldn't receive, or if it receives it even legally, should it be concerned with invasion of privacy in terms of what it prints?
I take it Professor Stark disagrees with you. Does somebody else want to speak to this or move us on with another question?
Members of the press here, they might want to comment.
I have another question.
This is another question. Go ahead. The question asks, how can the questioner find out whether the Highway Department keeps secret files? Whether they use this information in making judgmental determinations about driver's license suspensions. And I suppose, Terry and Matt, whether you consider it proper that they do this sort of thing.
Fellow members of the Civil Liberties Union. Thank you, young lady.
We're glad there's a man you here.
5 hours up. Ted, we appreciate your presence. I want to thank Patty Millard for rendering such yeoman service. Also, briefly, I'd like to introduce, at this time, several distinguished guests who are with us, and perhaps they'll stand. State Senator Frank Adams. And State Senator Jack Davies, our former Executive Secretary. And Congressman Don Fraser. There has been considerable speculation in the newspapers recently, and I've been out of town quite a bit, and so I'm probably not as well informed as I should be, but perhaps some of you share my lingering doubt as to just in whose hands the legal affairs of the state of Minnesota now rest. At any rate, when I was elected to this job, and I hasten to add, it was a 7-6 vote from the directors. I got a letter from the Attorney General congratulating me. At any rate, if the real Attorney General will stand up, perhaps he'll address us.
Peter, thank you for that introduction. I can answer your question. I have been the Attorney General for 4.5 years, and I've often wondered who is in charge of the legal affairs of the state. You know, the law in Minnesota does not require that the Attorney General be a lawyer, and my opponents in each election have said I've proved that beyond all reasonable doubt. Pay my respects to Frank Farrell, with whom I've worked during these years, Jack Pemberton, who is exuding the civil libertarian spirit of Minnesota across this land, Mr. Morgan, Mr. Casserly. I want to particularly acknowledge Judge Larson's presence here. It took me longer than the other members of the firm to get on the federal payroll, but I made it. And Don Fraser, who beat me by 2 years. I want to say that I'm delighted to be here. And say hello to my fellow members of the American and the Minnesota Civil Liberties Union. I've enjoyed my relationship with this organization during my period as Attorney General, and you have always been helpful and understanding in the many problems that one has that affect civil liberties in that office. This has been a busy and exciting week for the Mondale family, as you might imagine. It has been with some mixed blessing. I woke up with horror Wednesday morning to find out that my major credential for the office of the Senate was that I was a P-Lice inspector early in life. And that's probably one of the reasons I mentioned all of that. And also to hear from Teddy that he wasn't planning to move. He's like Cal Griffith. He likes the Twins and doesn't want to go back where they have those other things. I've really waited for 2 years, or since the time that Marsh Watson died, to say something that in public that I've wanted to say about Marsh. You know, I've never had, and I think many people in this room would say the same of themselves, a dearer friend than Marsh Watson. One who is in public affairs often wonders about, when he's tired at least, about the prevalence of bigotry. Sometimes existence of ignorance in surprising places, the recurrent evidences of hate that pop up from here and there and once again from surprising places, the materialism that often disappoints one, the selfishness that you see occasionally and in surprising places, and you're often disappointed as well at the apparent relentlessness of these human urges. And you see educated men who seem to be ignorant. And you see wealthy people who seem to be selfish. And you ask the question of whether this whole democratic experiment, this whole theory that men, if left to their own devices, can develop a society which brings out the best in men, which creates societies which Lippmann has referred to as possessed of the Western traditions of civility. And you begin to cast around for examples of men and women who have learned and who have understood and who've matured and who've dedicated themselves to these grand, noble, and I would say essential concepts. And if I were to pick one man in my life that I've known who represents what I would like to think every person should possess by way of qualities. A man of education, a man of intelligence, a man of humanity, a man of sensitivity, a strong but yet a gentle man, a man who was much more concerned about the lot and the liberty of others than of himself. I would say of all the men I've ever known, Marsh Watson would stand as that symbol. I'm proud to have known Marsh, and I'm glad to have the opportunity to say this in the presence of Peggy. I'm also glad to take this occasion to briefly tell you that, first of all, I'm not going to give a long speech. You'll be delighted to hear that. But secondly, that in the Senate, I am going to do all that I can to serve the cause of human rights, to do all that I can and I hope that in my time it can be said that no one is denied the right to vote, no one is denied the right to buy or rent housing that he wants, no one is denied a job, no one is denied the education, and no one is denied the fullness of American life because of his color or his religion. And I want to work toward that end. And I don't believe it's enough to remove the official and the unofficial barriers to these achievements. We must remove the obstacles of impoverishment and cultural deprival which harness and inhibit and discriminate as surely as color, and in most cases are found together. Because while we have become the richest society in the world, nearly one out of every five Americans is held behind in a color line, in a line which usually means our poverty line, in a line which usually means cultural deprival as well, which is as serious, which is as destructive of the human spirit, and is alien to the principles of equality as color discrimination is. And I hope that we have the will and the dedication and the knowledge in our time to see to it that our resources are used to overcome this economic and this cultural deprival, which whether it be in the sharecropper shacks of the South, or the Indian reservations in Minnesota, or the slums in the East, or wherever they're found, that it can be said that every person born in this country will have an opportunity in the fullest sense of the word to learn and to know and to grow and to love and to live along with every other American. And there is much more to be done in this field as well. And the same is true of the perennial problems of the protection of due process and of the liberty of our people. I believe that the United States Supreme Court and our systems of the independent judiciary constitutes one of the most unique, if not the most unique, creative and dynamic institutions for freedom anywhere in the world, and I intend to protect their integrity and their independence. I've enjoyed working with the law enforcement officers of Minnesota, whether the police or the sheriffs or the prosecutors. And I've enjoyed equally well working with our law school, our law schools, and working with the leaders of the civil liberties movement in this state. And I want to say to those of you who are concerned about due process protections that the law enforcement officers of Minnesota, in most instances, are concerned about these problems as you are. And that if I learned one thing as a person committed to civil liberties during this 4 years that I've been on the prosecutor's side, it is that one of the basic problems in civil liberties in the United States today is that the police and those who believe in civil liberties spend too much time arguing with each other and too little time trying to understand each other. And I think that those of us who support the court as they raise the standards required of law enforcement officers must understand at the same time that the cost of law enforcement, the need for better training, for the need for better professionalization increases correspondingly. And we must be active in both fields. In all of these areas, I just want you to know in saying hello tonight that I'm going to do the best that I can. I know practically everyone in this room. I want your help and your advice. And I just hope that you will feel free to call upon me at any time. Thank you so much.
Well, after hearing Fritz, I suppose you can understand why I personally am so delighted with his appointment. I was beginning to think maybe he was going to come back into the private practice of law. A competition like that we don't need. I know we all wish you well, Fritz. While flushed with the inspiration of the senator designates, I practice at a speech. It probably would be a good time to hear from our longtime board member, our ex-president, that unsuccessful Republican candidate for office, Frank Barrow.
Thank you, Peter. Sergeant Designate Bondale, Congressman Fraser, distinguished guests, and fellow civil libertarians. I have a very sharp pitch to give you tonight, and I'll make it very brief, because I want to get on to our main entree here, Jack Pemberton and Chuck Morgan. But I want to discuss some figures with you this evening. I know figures are dull things, but they're important to this organization as they are to every organization. So if you'll bear with me, let us run through them briefly. Let us talk first about the annual income of this organization. The year 1963, the Minnesota branch raised a total that year of $16,700 in this state. What happened to that money? The first $2.50 of every annual membership goes to the national organization. Everything that's contributed and your annual contribution above the $2.50 is shared.
What the fellow is saying is that we need the dough. Each year at our annual banquet, we present a Marsh Watson Memorial Award. And we have a committee that's appointed by the president for the purpose of screening of any qualified candidates for receipt of it. However, prior to calling on the committee members, I would like to take this brief opportunity to give thanks to probably the best and greatest living memorial a man could have, Marsh's wife, Peg, who is here. If she would please stand up. Our award committee this year consisted of three eminently qualified men. As I mentioned their names, I'll also ask them to stand up if they will, please. The first is a member of our board of directors, the Reverend Dr. Howard Kahn. Second man is the first president of this organization, the Honorable Earl Larson. If he had stood up a little longer, I would have told him he was overruled. Finally, the chairman of the committee, I take it the other two selected him, is Bernie Casserly. Bernie is a member of our board of directors. He's also editor of the Catholic Bulletin. The man I am going to introduce, however, reminds me a little of a story that you probably all heard. If I know it, everybody knows it. They send those over as ticker tapes after the market closes. At any rate, they tell a story about Claire Booth Luce, who, when after being converted to Catholicism, became ambassador to Italy. And as such, she had a private audience with the Pope. And in the month in which the National Board of the ACLU decided that they would hire me to become their executive director, and while I was still out in Minnesota. That same month, Ernest Angel had written a letter to the New York Times explaining the special problems that the ACLU had in finding attorneys willing to take controversial cases, which means cases involving a Negro as a litigant in the South, and calling upon bar associations to face up to the professional responsibility of seeing that no man's cause fails for want of a courageous lawyer to participate in it. And it was shortly after that letter was published that Mel Wolf passed on to me a letter received in the national office from a lawyer in Birmingham, Alabama, the first I had heard of this lawyer, who said, well, there are some lawyers in the South who are not afraid of controversial cases, and perhaps you hadn't heard of us. And since that letter was received, Chuck Morgan started taking cases for the ACLU, and they weren't all cases involving the segregation issue. In fact, one of the most fascinating cases shows something of the indivisibility of civil liberties and civil rights, for it involved the denial of a right to hold a public meeting and make speeches in the state of Alabama to the arch-segregationist National States Rights Party. And they, too, experienced the rawness of a society that is not willing to tolerate controversy and dissent. Chuck took that case for us, and he took many others. But a year ago, a little more than a year ago, when the Birmingham church bombings brought an end to Chuck's willingness to tolerate in silence what had participated in his community, and I don't mean to say that he was silent before that. He was just peculiarly outspoken at that time. The capacity of a lawyer whose community felt him completely out of step with its thinking and its demand for conformity came to an end, and Chuck had to leave the private practice of the law. And it's through that circumstance that we're fortunate enough to have Chuck with us. Now, before I introduce Chuck, I want to make one point, and that is that the full story of his practice of law in Birmingham, fascinating story that it is, can be found in a book that's been written by him entitled A Time to Speak. And since Chuck, unlike me, had to abandon the practice of law, which he couldn't get any partners to take over from him and compensate him for, I think it's fairly important that Chuck get a few royalties from this book. So I'll repeat the title. It is A Time to Speak, and the author is Charles Morgan. But now the time to speak has really come, and I give you the man you've been waiting to hear, Chuck Morgan.
to Jack. Those of us who know him well lovingly call him Jack. Some of the rest of us say Boss. And we're pleased that you gave him to us, Senator Designate Attorney General Mondale. I'm particularly pleased to have had the pleasure this evening of having dined with your new Senator Designate. He is taking the place and filling the seat of a former member of the United States Senate that, or soon to be a former member, that you gave the nation and for which you should be eternally proud. For we in the South know Hubert Humphrey to be the kind of a man in the North, unlike many others who through apathy and otherwise have failed to do their duties. Hubert Humphrey has been a man whose voice has been heard and whose relentless pursuit of civil liberties and justice for Southerners and his vindication for many of the democratic processes in the Civil Rights Act's passage in the United States Senate is a constant source of encouragement to a great number of Americans. I must confess that when I sat down at the table earlier on the way in, I was very pleased to have been met at the airport, and I had a large document with me that I was reading. And I provided it to a member of your group, and he returned it to me this evening. And as I sat at the table, someone said, "Is that your speech?" And I said, now I refuse to say, unaccustomed as I am, this is really a white paper on the FBI. Literally a white paper on the FBI. And Jack, I want to thank you for the two mentions of my book, A Time to Speak. I'm now in the process of writing a sequel to it, entitled A Time to Shut Up. And I think, after this week's newspapers, I may dedicate it to Mr. Hoover. I must mention to you that my environment and background is somewhat different from yours, and consequently my view of life is a bit different, and my view of the South is a bit different, I'm quite certain, from some of the ideas that you have. I know that race is the central theme of Southern life. It has been the central theme of Southern life, for some time be the central theme of Southern existence, political, economic, social. The South centers on the race question. The Deep South, more than other sections of the South. I know this, and I know that from this single question, there arise all of the civil liberties problems you have, plus all of the additional problems that they have in the South. For instance, if you're worried about prayer in schools, you haven't got a single problem here that they haven't got there. Because you name the county and you name the school district, and they've got prayer in schools. As a matter of fact, in one district in Georgia, I was putting my son in school there, and I discovered that in one of the school districts, they pray for the state of Georgia. I'm almost willing to engraft an exception on the ruling for that purpose, but not quite. Working for the American Civil Liberties Union in the South may be a little difficult. Some people have asked me about how Atlanta is as a place to have an office. Atlanta is that place in the South that if you were flying from Mississippi or Alabama to New York or Washington, and you didn't have a layover in it, you'd get the bends. It's not that it's so good, it's not that it's so bad, it's just one big decompression chamber, and it is the grandest place to be. But there are still problems. For instance, if you go there for the American Civil Liberties Union, and you tell someone what you're doing, they say, "For who?" And you can understand their chagrin because you see the words that are involved. American is not too well regarded in some sectors down there. Civil has become a pretty bad word along the way. Liberties isn't too good. And union, they ain't had none of in some places ever. Now, I know you think people down there are different from people elsewhere. They're not. People are people wherever they are. Those people are trapped, many of them, and those people have different sorts of problems from other people. I know that in Birmingham, where I lived,
I know some young lawyers who had to give up their positions with the law firm because they were involved in negotiating simply a settlement of the May demonstrations and in trying to ameliorate racial difficulty. They were given an option: continue with your activities or quit. It wasn't quite put in those words. Good law firms don't do that. They left. Another young lawyer with a good-sized law firm there, and by the way, I want to mention to you that a great amount of legal business goes south from the north, and a great amount of it is funneled into those lawyers who, if they recognize the existence of the Supreme Court of the United States, if the Supreme Court of the United States bit them on the leg, they wouldn't understand that it existed, let alone others. One young lawyer there wrote a letter to the State Superintendent of Education. It was a nice letter. It was one page. It was very moderate and temperate. And it was a sort of letter, you know, like this. If we haven't had a lot of prayer in schools before, the governor had just made another one of his brave statements. He was through waltzing in the schoolhouse door. And he had then issued a restatement after the Supreme Court prayer decision that he was going to go into every classroom in Alabama and personally read the Bible, and they would not lay their, quote, filthy, end quote, hands on him, which was a very brave remark. And at that point, the young lawyer wrote a letter to the State Superintendent of Education, says, why require prayers for the simple purpose that they've ruled the other way? And the letter came back to him and to the eight members of his law firm, and a short while later, someone came in and said, I would like to see all your personal correspondence for the last year. And in my office, he came, and we had coffee. And you know, lawyers, both personally and sometimes with clients, give sort of flip advice. I have one lawyer friend there who got a call one day saying, lawyer so-and-so, my husband John's off with another woman. What'll I do? And he was tired, I guess, because over the phone he says, well, I don't know. When he comes home, shoot him. And she called back about 4 hours later and says, I'm down at the police station. What do I do now? So the summary of our discussion was, ask to see their personal correspondence for the last year. And he's in Chicago now with an excellent law firm. I know that in the South and in Birmingham, the peaceful, nonviolent Negroes, one of them, an attorney, the dean of the Negro attorneys in our state, has not left his automobile in more than 20 years without the cold steel of pistol in his hand. I know that many people in Birmingham have looked through the Venetian blinds in the middle of the night when they heard a car out front. Their dogs, when they barked at night, they weren't urged to be quiet. They were allies. I know that the searchlights outside some houses, people sometimes wondered whether they ought to be there because you might be a better target. I know that through this, people have lived in an unreal world. But for the average person in Birmingham, life was pleasant, life was good, they weren't involved. Demonstrations downtown, that's downtown. Not on that nice little green plot of grass we've got in the suburbs. Now, one of the great problems, I think, in American life is that people in the suburbs, and the good, kind, gentle people, the ones who graduate from college, get married, get an apartment, get a little green plot of grass, get a good job, work for the day when they can have two martinis at lunch, the high aims and goals maybe of Thursday afternoon golf, have their daughter marry a bright young man, not too bright. And then go through life until age 65, when they then would reside upon Social Security, against which, of course, they voted during their entire life. For these people, the worst word in the world is controversy. That's the bad word. He's controversial. He's this. It's a terrible word. Now, for these people, though, who are not participants, the world is a sweet, kind thing. Some of you, and I've chatted with you, have visited in Birmingham, know that what I speak of is true. But for the others, life was different. And why was it? Because it was a community isolated. It's a community where they read the 12 articles on the Negro in the North by Harry Ashmore, but they didn't read the 13 articles on the Negro in the South by Harry Ashmore. Columnists in the two papers, they went from Marcus Childs or Lippmann, you name it, even Drew Pearson, They were dropped over a 10-year period. They began to disappear, and the oracles of the community became Henry J. Taylor and that noted constitutional authority, David Lawrence. And if all you read is David Lawrence, you become absolutely certain before you're through that the 14th Amendment not only is not constitutional, but it doesn't really exist. It, like Mr. Lawrence and perhaps the race problem, is merely a pigment of their imaginations, and they don't know. They really don't know what's going on in the rest of the world. And let me give you some more examples. They didn't see the white paper on CBS or on NBC on the sit-ins. They didn't see Who Speaks for the South on CBS. They didn't see ABC's Walk in My Shoes. Now, I saw ABC's Walk in My Shoes. It had been advertised in the paper, and it was scheduled, and suddenly it was canceled. The day it was canceled, 10 community leaders, including me, and I really wasn't a community leader. There were 9 others, and I was the loudmouth. We were invited up for a private showing so we'd all understand why it wasn't shown. And I watched it. It was a pretty good show. And we got through and went up to the club, and we had, 20 drinks. I don't know how many before the station manager brought it up. And then he says, "You understand why we didn't show this, don't you?" And everybody understood. It was obviously communist-inspired. It would have only stirred up trouble in the community. And, of course, I told him, let them kick their TV screens out, but show it. They own their sets, but show it. But they never saw it. It was not just prejudice that met people in the streets of Birmingham in demonstrations. It was ignorance. And this exists not just in Birmingham, but all over the South. And people all over the country add to it. The cab driver in New York who talks a certain way when he hears a Southern accent. And that person goes South and they have a new race relations expert and a new expert in the North. When George Wallace gets X number of votes in X state, everybody back down home says, you know, they really agree with us. I'm absolutely convinced that a great percentage of the people in Mississippi almost had heart failure on election night because they knew that on the race question, which they were thinking about even if some others weren't, they knew that the country really was beginning to agree with them. And this exists not just with whites, it exists with Negroes. For the average person in the South, the average housewife, the racial expert is the maid. And the maid says, I heard a friend of mine, the wife of a state legislator, kept saying, my maid doesn't agree with Martin Luther King or Fred Shuttlesworth. She's not with them. They don't like them. My maid tells me that. And I kept saying to her, look, your maid's lying to you. And I reckon your maid's got a constitutional right to lie to you because everybody else lies to their employer, so why can't she? Well, she didn't understand this. So naturally, she went maybe to 40 cocktail and bridge parties and the same conversational pattern, my maid, my maid, my maid. Well, one ABC show did get through, and there on the front row at Fred Shuttlesworth's church was her maid. And she saw it, in keeping with the Southern tradition of paternalism, she had to fire the maid, of course. It was a very difficult decision, but it was rapid. People don't say what they mean. People don't talk the way they ought to talk. And folks down there, they come north for a sales meeting, and everybody says, well, you know, you've got a peculiar problem down there. We understand how it is. But people don't like to be disliked. I know, I'm disliked. People don't like it. And they want to be a part of the society. They want to be a part of America. But they're looking for rationalizations, for new fictions, new ways. The civil rights question is not just a Southern problem, and the answer is not just a Southern solution. Because of the newspapers I named, one was Scripps Howard, one was Newhouse. Of the two television stations in that city, one is Taft Broadcasting, and one's Newhouse. Now the decisions, if you ask them about these decisions, they'd say, well, we leave local policy up to the local editor or the local manager. And with respect to the newspapers, say Scripps Howard, that's true, except it's not true when you have editorials on the tax cut, and it's not true when you have editorials on Medicare, and it's not true when you have editorials on the presidential race. It's only true on race. But when it's race, it's local. because race is controversial and it's tough. Now, someplace in the North, some decisions have got to start making some decisions. The management and ownership of property places with it a responsibility with respect to the South. The conversational patterns in the North, a responsibility with respect to the South. Now, many people mix up, many people ask me, someone this afternoon says, how long will it be? Well, I don't know what they're talking about, because there are two problems here. One of them is the problem of the law and equal rights in the South, and the other is the problem of the hearts and minds of men. Now, on the hearts and minds of men, most of the people that I hear talk about this have heart trouble or mind trouble. I'm not particularly concerned, and I don't think most Negroes in the South are particularly concerned with whether or not somebody loves them. They want to vote. They want a job. They want a cup of coffee. They're not concerned with whether somebody loves them or not. We've got to take care of the first steps first, and then we've got to rely on people to work the problems out after that. Now, we have in the ACLU in the South, we'll have real problems. We'll have problems procuring counsel. For a white lawyer in the South, for instance, if you ask him to handle a controversial case, you'll have a real problem. So will he. In the North, everyone wants somebody in the South to speak out. It's a very difficult thing. He's pledging maybe his life and his fortune in exchange for his honor. The Negro lawyer who takes a case, it presents great problems to him, but he at least goes back to his community somewhat of a hero. The white lawyer who takes such a case goes back somewhat of a pariah. With respect to controversial race cases, what do I mean? Well, the Fields case that Jack mentioned, Edward R. Fields wanted to have a white workers' meeting above, and I love this phrase, quote, above the car wash in Fairfield. He was enjoined. He went out and allegedly violated the injunction. He was convicted of contempt, and the question was, could he raise in the contempt proceeding the validity of the injunction, which he said was invalid on its face. Now, that's not a controversial race case. 1 year later, Martin Luther King and Fred Shuttlesworth violated a substantially similar injunction. And they, in turn, had the same problem. Can they raise it in a contempt proceeding, its validity? That's a controversial race case. And that's where your problem comes. I want to mention to you the need for the North, the need for constant pressure. People talk about outside agitators, and states' rights, and this sort of thing with respect to race, and I can assure you of one thing, that had this matter been left up to local people, had it always been left up to the local folks to work their problems out in the South, I wouldn't be talking to you tonight about civil rights. I'd be talking to you about slavery. We'd have worked out a new way, a new rationalization, a new thought, a new justification. It would have been there. And we'd have had our apologists. We're doing our best to, you know, we know it's bad, but it's necessary. I can hear it now. Now, the Negro movement in the South came out of the churches. Where it's going, I don't know, but that's where it came from. It came out of, the white man always let the Negro have the Christian religion. It was a nice thing for him to have. He could think about the future, the world was good to him, and there was never any problem on the white side from the Christian church. For many years, you know, not now, I think in the last 3 years we've seen the church becoming an active, vibrant organization in society. But prior to that time, the proper slogan could have been on television, go to the Supreme Court of your choice on Sunday, but go to the Supreme Court. In the South, the Negro, he meets in churches. That's where he can meet. His leaders are Dr. So-and-so and Reverend So-and-so. And an arrest, a demonstration, a time in the streets in Birmingham, it's almost an act of rebirth. It's almost a baptism. Now, there's an old poem by a fellow named Oppenheim, which is called The Slave. And I'll paraphrase it. It goes something like this. They struck the chains from the slave, and he remained a slave. Chained to sloth, ignorance, indolence, and servility. Strike the chains from a free man, and he'll be free. But that never happens, for free men strike the chains from themselves. And that's what Negroes are doing. Many white people that I know, well-intentioned, say, we're going to give them their rights. What have we got to give? They've got the rights, and they're taking them. And a lot of people resent that. Well, I'm for that. And I think in that lies much of the salvation of this nation. I know that when demonstrators are met in streets, I know that people with new rationalizations and old premises, things are very rational to the man in the bushes with the gun in the middle of the night who's watching Medgar Evers. And when he squeezes that trigger, you see, he may really think of himself as Patrick Henry. And that's hard to visualize, but it's true. He has all sorts of different kinds of dreams and schemes and plans and bases for things. And he really believes, a great number of hymns believe, they believe one thing, that the Negro is basically inferior to them. Now, when you're dealing with this, it takes a toughness in the South. And it takes a remembrance that things can change. I know in Birmingham, the Alabama Highway Patrol, the affable, friendly Alabama Highway Patrol. The folks you worried about if you'd had a drink and you were driving, or you'd look over your shoulder if you were on the highway going too fast. But you'd always say to yourself, if my wife's out alone on the highway, or if there's a flat tire, we've got somebody at least to help along the way. They changed. We got a new governor. And overnight one night, they came to Birmingham, and they came 700 strong. This time they didn't have on soft hats, they had on hard helmets. They had little Confederate battle flags up here as an insignia. The front bumpers of the automobiles, Confederate battle flags. They carried carbines, had electric prod poles. They got out with riot guns. On the backs of the cars, and there'd been no warrant of law for this, no announcement, no legislative change of the name, but in a near Freudian slip, they weren't the Highway Patrol anymore. Because in big black and yellow letters, they were state troopers. And they were state troopers, at least. And you know, people talk to me about there's an act of violence or there's a little glimmer of hope. We go so far with hope. When the kids died in the church, many people thought, this will do it. They can't take this. But when you've tolerated bombing after bombing after bombing after bombing, you become inured to violence. I was sitting at dinner on the second occasion in two or three years with the same two men. One was Justin Finger from the Anti-Defamation League. The other was a fellow named Bob Baker from the Washington Post. We're out of my house eating. I don't know if you've heard a bomb in other than wartime conditions, but just a dull thud off of the background. And Baker turned and he says, I think that was a bomb, wasn't it? And Finger says, yeah, I think it was. And my wife says, please pass the salt. Berlin, after the Night of Crystal in 1938, when they dragged the Jews out of the shops and the temples, must have been a lot like Birmingham and other places in the South after an act of violence. You remember Neshoba County, Philadelphia? Remember what they said? They said those three had gone to Cuba. Then they said, no, it's just a fundraising stunt. In Birmingham, the same sort of thing. The janitor did it. The Negroes did it to themselves. The little girls were sneaking a smoke in the restroom and flipped some a cigarette on the dynamite they were storing in the church. That's why it went off. Wild, weird thoughts. But if Pierre had gone into Berlin and seen his old friend Hans, he'd have probably said something to him like this after the Night of Crystal. He'd have said, Hans, Hans, what's happened here in Germany? What's happened? What about last night? And Hans would have said to him, now, Pierre, first of all, I'm no Nazi. You know that. And I'm no Hitler man. And I don't approve of what the stormtroopers did here last night. But ordinarily, the stormtroopers do a pretty good job of preserving law and order around here. And you know, we wouldn't have a Jewish problem in Germany if it weren't for the communists and the agitators. And if things were really so bad here for the Jews, well, they'd leave. They couldn't be that bad. And you know, the real problem we got here in Berlin is you French reporters coming in here from the outside. All you're doing is writing about us and Germany and spoiling our image all over the world. Now, I was particularly pleased with your award tonight for the young people who received it are part of a generation of which I, for one, think we can be proud. I'm not nearly so worried about Mr. Hoover's comments on juveniles as I am about the actions of young people living in a time of crisis. I sometimes get discouraged, as does everyone. When I was in college in the early 50s, well, 1951, in a political science course, very small seminar, some of us were worried about a United States senator named Joseph McCarthy. A young man in the class was particularly disturbed, and Professor Albert Lepofsky went out and came back with a letter. He read it to us. It went something like this. It said, "Dear Albert, you're quite correct in your recollection of our recent conversation." The letter came from a man named Lewis Brownlow. He's an author of several books, amongst them Passion for Anonymity. He was a creative genius in government. He died last September. When I was a young reporter in Washington, one day I was walking across the street from the old House office building. I was with Representative Arthur Sladen from Texas and an elderly gentleman named Colonel Maury, also from Texas. He's a relative and an ancestor of Maury Maverick. And that day we were walking across the street in 1904 or 5. Representative Sladen was worried about a school board problem in the district. He was on the district committee. And he turned to me and he said, "Have you ever seen a school board that wasn't composed of absolute nincompoops?" And at that point, Brownlow said, he responded that he hadn't. And the elderly gentleman, Colonel Maury, with gray hair down his neck, little black string tie, harumphed, and he said, "Well, I've seen such a school board, gentlemen, and my father was a member of it. When I was a little boy in Albemarle County, Virginia, I walked down a dusty road one day with him and with my hand in his, and we met three other members of the board, the fifth member being absent. And that day, the four present voted to build another schoolhouse in Albemarle County. And that day," the old man said, "he met Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, and James Monroe. A man died last year who met a man who had met Madison, Jefferson, and Monroe. We live in a very young nation with young ideas. And with our young people in years and in mind and spirit, we can make this if we live up to our dreams and act in the youthful sense of purpose which we all must act. We can make this truly a land of greatness and the light for all the free world. I urge you to join with us and help us with that task in the South. Thank you."
Very much. I'm sure any words I could say would be inadequate to express our feeling about your talk. I do think that you've highlighted a significant difference between your southern community and our state of Minnesota, and of course it rests in the fine people who are in this room. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you very much. Right about now, I'd like to answer a few questions, if there are any.
Tell us a little about Big Spiderbeck.
Big Spiderbeck was a legendary trumpet player many people haven't heard, and because he was here and gone before anybody looked around. At the time I knew him, there were two trumpet players I once spoke of. One was Armstrong, the other was Bix. Of course, it's fashionable nowadays to say, and you take this as it reads rather than how it sounds, I slept with Bix. Everybody either lived with somebody, or they worked with them, or studied with them, or they slept in the same house and broke bread. Tell you the truth, I had one jam session with Bix. I happened to be in a club, and maybe this explains Bix better than anything I can say. He sat at a table and didn't want to play. The spotlight found him and forced him to get up, acknowledge the applause. And don't forget, the listeners in those days were musicians. The club, the Three Deuces, was supported strictly by the musicians. People didn't know about this music. Bix got up and played for the musicians. I happened to be in the house, and I think, had the band, says, would you sit in? I sat in. I didn't get up. We played and played and played and played until the porter swept us out of the place 6 o'clock in the morning. This I know about Bix, he loved to play. And during the night he got up from we got up for a short break, he put the horn down and sat down at the piano. He sure played a wonderful piano. And much of it could be considered modern today. So, as to describing his style, all I can do is whet your appetite, say, listen to him. I can't say that he hit a demented sixth or a German fifth, or he ran up and down or down and up. I wouldn't know how to describe his playing, except what he did to me. And he did a lot of nice things.
Two things I want to ask you were, one is, have you been doing anything in the Leroy Carr style? And second, the first blues in the 8-bar form I heard of was Leroy Carr's Hollow On. Can you tell me more about the 8-bar form you were doing?
Well, Leroy Carr was, everybody asks questions that bring back memories. Walking down State Street, 35th and State in Chicago, seeing the record shop and going in there to buy some Louis records over the counter at 75 cents a piece. Stan Louis records that you used to pay $8 and $10 and $12 for later on. Why, I keep hearing the same record over and over again on the turntable, and after about the 10th playing, it finally permeates me that, what is this? And it's Leroy Carr. And doing a tune, that's all right for you, baby. And there's nobody that sang quite like him. Big Bill Brunsey worked with Carr, and you know, in those days, two singers would many times appear on the same record together. One would play the guitar and the other would sing. Whoever was the best singer sang, the other one played the guitar. So Big Bill had a lot of Carr style. Now, the point is that when I bought that record, it was the only one they had in the store. Now, I went in the store, it was summertime, there was all sorts of colored folks sitting on both sides of the curb listening to this music. When I went out, they had started to get up and go, because they had taken that record off the turntable and sold it to me, and that broke up the concert. That's what they thought of that record. And, of course, I've valued it ever since. Now, Leroy Carr, this Harlem blues, like you say, it is an 8-bar blues, and there were 8-bar blues, because that's all I needed to make that sort of statement, as opposed to 12 bars. Maybe I would play and you can hear it.
Thank you.
about the Austin High Gang? The Austin High Gang, Condon, Dave Tuff, George Wetling, Bud Freeman, Jimmy McPartland. This was the Chicago, what they call the second line in New Orleans jargon, the kids that followed the band. And these are the kids that, as Benny Goodman said, he put his long pants on so that they let him in the school. School, of course, was the cabaret that Louis and King Oliver were playing in. And the Austin High Gang, well, these were the kids. Some of them were going to Austin High at the time or had just quit going to Austin High. I think many of the musicians I know that you were talking about didn't quite make it in school. We had to choose up sides early then. Of course, some of them are still around today playing music and playing music very well. But not too many of them went to Austin High that are considered the Austin High Gang.
You made this comment, you quoted somebody, stop the war, who was it that you were quoting?
Wayne Manone. He made a recording called Stop the War, The Cats Are Killing Themselves, and he did this, oh, maybe in 38. That's how long ago. Of course, it's very timely now because... Any other questions?
You ever done anything with Doc Evans?
Yes. Doc Evans is one of the trump players that I played with that makes a lot of sense on the horn, besides being a real nice fellow to work alongside. And when you say Doc Evans, I feel nice. He's a real fine fellow, and there are any blows. Yes, sir.
Good point to stop, so you're right back home. I think of two words to describe this evening. One is impeccable and the other is unimpeachable.